Welcome to today's program titled Barbarian at the Gate, Class Action Avoidance and Mitigation for Data Breach. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located on the left corner of your screen. Then type and send your question that way. This presentation has been prepared by Seyfarth Shaw, LLP, for informational purposes only and not legal advice. This information is not intended to create and receive of it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or a legal option on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. For those interested in obtaining CLE credits for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form sent with the login information email. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for a CLE credit. To ask a question via the web presentation, go to the chat box located on the lower left corner of your computer screen, type your question in the text box, then click on the send message button. You can submit your questions at any time during the webinar, and they will be addressed during the Q&A sessions at the end of the program. If you'd like to download a copy of the presentation materials, you may do so from the handout tab in the conference materials pod on the left side of your screen. At this time, I would like to turn it over to Robert Milligan. You may begin.
Thank you so much, and thank you to the audience for joining us today regarding our webinar, Barbarians at the Gate, Class Action Avoidance and Mitigation for Data Breach. We're going to have a high-level discussion today as we take a look at avoidance and mitigation techniques for data breach, including where the class action plaintiff bar is going and what potential defenses and strategies companies can employ in such lawsuits. This webinar is intended for businesses such as retailers, financial service providers, healthcare providers, and energy companies with an interest in the future of data breach and cybersecurity litigation, regulation policy development. With that, I'd like to introduce you to our speakers today. We're joined by Bart Lazar. Bart is one of the prominent privacy professionals in the nation. He's a partner in our Chicago office. He counsels clients in intellectual property, data privacy and security, advertising, promotion, and related matters. Mr. Lazar has handled numerous privacy matters before federal and state agencies, including defending the first internet privacy case brought by the Federal Trade Commission and the first database security breach case brought by the New York Attorney General. I'm also joined by John Tomaszewski. He's a senior counsel in our Houston office. He has significant experience counseling companies regarding data protection and information security throughout the Americas, Europe, and Asia. His clients have included a myriad of technology companies, as well as financial services, pharmaceuticals, e-commerce companies of all sizes. And lastly, my name is Robert Milligan. I'm a partner in our Los Angeles office of Seyfarth Shaw. I am the co-chair of our Non-Compete and Trade Secrets group, and we're so happy that you were able to join us for our third installment of our Trade Secrets webinar series. We have an ambitious agenda today, and we've divided it into three main components. First, John Tomaszewski is going to cover the building blocks for a global privacy program and how to avoid breaches in the first place. Bart Lazar is then going to discuss incident management, namely that no program is perfect and what to do when an incident happens and how to effectively handle data breach notifications, including addressing government investigations. Mr. Lazar has significant experience in that regard. And then finally, I'm going to discuss class action defense. And just because you handled your incident doesn't mean that it's over, and how to best position your company when class action data breach actions are filed, including effectively pursuing dispositive motions and addressing putative class certifications issues. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Bart Lazar to get into our first topic.
Thanks, Robert. I'm going to just frame the discussion a little bit before John tells us how to build this, build your program. The first thing, and a lot of us know this, but why are we even concerned about security at all and security breaches in general? And one is because it's just very prevalent. And in order to, I think, to justify within your organization taking action on a proactive basis to prevent and reduce security breaches, you need to know what the ROI is within your own organization. So what is going on? One, it's the number one crime in the United States, and it, although it's starting to flatten out, some of the most significant breaches the United States has had has occurred within the last year. If you look at privacyrights.org, which has the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse, which has information regarding security breaches, they've recorded in the 8.5 years that, or 9 years that they've recorded publicly announced breaches, over 4,000 breaches. And I got to tell you, the suspected incidents and the actual incidents are much more than that. So we've got a lot of breaches that are occurring, and even more suspected. And we also care because of the costs, and the costs range from the actual time and resources within a company of individuals like yourselves, or hiring outside counsel like John or myself or Robert to respond, to handle incident investigation response, or an outside technical vendor. Symantec and the Poneman Institute, in their most recent analysis, have said that the cost of responding to a data security breach is $188 per record. So when you're talking about the kind of incidents that I often get involved in, when we're talking about, you know, 10,000 or more employee records or customer records, that is a lot of money. And that's just either spent by the company or spent on their own internal time and resources. Also, the loss of potential of actual business. Again, Symantec and Poneman estimate that each business loses approximately $3 million because of a typical breach situation. And as an intellectual property trademark lawyer, I can also attest to the value of the goodwill. There are issues relating to the trust from the relationship between either an employee and the company or a consumer and the company, resulting from the loss of data. I do believe that consumers in the United States have become more hardened to this situation. It's less likely that that people will take it out on their company as a result of a breach. There still is a lot of consumer-driven action that they ignore notices, but we can't rely on that. And I think Robert will tell us later that it's not just that people aren't ignoring these notices; they're handing them off to. They're seeing that there's an opportunity to take action in the form of the class action lawsuits. So there are a lot of reasons. And finally, you've got the enforcement. I put on top, but maybe it's the last. The Federal Trade Commission has established a very strong record of going after companies for security breaches. They're taking positions like, in law, what negligence is in the air. If you have a security breach, it's almost by definition there was something wrong. Now, any of your technical experts, and John and I and Robert will tell you, look, you can do the best you can, and you're not going to eliminate security breaches because things happen. But the fact of the matter is the regulators aren't always following that position. So I also thought it'd be helpful in framing the situation to see where we are in terms of where breaches come from. In the past, we would say, oh, hacking. Everyone is always talking about hacking, but hacking is not the number one source of security breaches. And it may not be the number one, but it's growing, and criminal and malicious conduct is the growing area. And it's a combination of outsider hacking and insider action. This past year, I've seen an increase in some of the traditional garden variety employee theft cases where employees are recording information, they're taking files home, they're reviewing drug testing records and getting involved in identity theft rings as a result of using their insider status to take that information and sell it or utilize it themselves. But also we, of course, have the outsider rings that have been very successful in finding vulnerabilities in some what we thought were for some very secure methods of managing and transmitting information. We still have a lot of situations that relate to negligence. Employees, and one of the things that I get involved in a great deal is analyzing the employee negligence situations to see, are we just giving access to information? Who is getting this information? And I'd say that is an extremely, that is, happens, this is the Poneman analysis and Symantec, but I see employee negligence happening as much as the rest. And similarly, glitches or vulnerabilities. Luckily, they get reported, but there's a lot of situations where there are some glitches where people can utilize an application and get access or control of data that they're not supposed to get to. And although it's not a statistical thing, I find that service providers are the greatest source of security breaches. That's because of outsourcing. Everyone is outsourcing. Everyone is putting things up on the cloud. Everyone is utilizing service providers, whether it's for payroll, employee benefits, or for direct mail, direct marketing, or collecting sweepstakes information. And the less control you have over your service providers, as we'll talk about shortly, the more that becomes a significant issue, whether you are a service provider for someone else or if you have service providers working for you. But now I'm going to turn it over to John, and he's going to talk about the blocking and tackling. Can you take the basic fundamentals of a privacy and data protection program and actually mitigate your risk? John?
Thank you, Bart. So now that Bart has explained the threat landscape and hopefully put a little bit of concern into your minds with regard to data protection and security, I'm going to help describe some of the things that companies can do to avoid having a breach, or at least avoid the size of a breach in the first place. The first thing, obviously, that everybody talks about is, well, what do you have to do? And when you look at some of the legislation that's out there, whether it's Gramm-Leach-Bliley or it's HIPAA or it's some of the other rules, you see language that is kind of difficult to understand. The three words that are often used are administrative, technical, and procedural safeguards. The problem is, what the heck does that mean? So the first thing you end up doing is you end up saying, okay, well, we have to have these safeguards to achieve something. So what is it we're trying to achieve? Understanding what security is really about is a critical component to understanding how to implement a set of controls and control objectives around achieving that result. A lot of folks think that it's just simply a IT issue. Can we get the right kind of firewall in place? And it's a lot more than that. Technical tools are important, but there are also a whole host of other requirements that tie into how you manage your workforce, how your functions achieve access to data, and most of that data is probably going to be electronic. So what you end up with is you end up with a much more complex structure and a need to put a framework around that complexity so that it's manageable. security really requires more than just a stop at the door. A lot of folks will put together a security posture which only deals with prevention and maybe a little bit of detection. The unfortunate thing is the front door is not the only way into the house. The Target breach taught us, if nothing else, be careful of your vendors, because somebody you may have provided authorization to may end up being compromised, and as a consequence, you have more of a concern around detection as opposed to front-end prevention. So depending on the risk profile that you have, which of course you've got to figure that out first, you may need to add a little bit more effort in terms of prevention or in terms of verification. But regardless, a good security program which will help protect you from a breach situation is going to require all of these components in terms of defense in depth. So now that you've talked about, now that I've talked about what those layers are, how do you actually put a framework around it? Because those layers are kind of complicated. Security governance looks a heck of a lot like other types of standard corporate governance structures. A lot of the times when people ask me what I do, I talk about how I provide counsel around corporate governance for information assets. Very much like you have corporate governance around your financial reporting and your money, you need to have corporate governance around your information assets. Obviously, this starts off with a set of policies, which are then supported by standards, which are then implemented by processes and procedures. So let's get into what those policy elements are going to look like. First off, obviously, you've got to have, since this is a policy level, you've got to have tone at the top. Really get involved in not just analyzing, but prioritizing security as an important thing. The challenge with this is security is, in oftentimes, antithetical to a business objective. So there also needs to be an understanding on how to balance the alignment of business objectives between security, which is nobody should have access to anything, and the business, which is, hey, we need to be able to communicate with our customers, with our suppliers, with our vendors. This top-level understanding will actually be able to provide a balance such that any security posture is actually going to be implementable and it won't get in the way of the business moving forward. This is most obviously seen in terms of how it gets integrated between executives and line management, people having an understanding of what the meets and bounds of their capabilities are in terms of what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do. Now that you've got these policies in place, how do you actually implement them? There are a whole series of standards that are floating around out there that are very good for folks to look at. NIST has a series of standards that are associated with government and military level security, but a lot of it goes into some basic things like, do you change the default passwords? If so, what do those passwords need to look like? Do you have encryption requirements? Are those encryption requirements associated with only data that's in transit, in other words, floating around in email or FTP, or is it at rest in databases? Simple things like configuration standards. When you have a new laptop come on board, do you allow the USB ports to be accessed? Depending on whether or not that's a point-of-sale terminal, you may not want to have those ports accessed. And that's a standards document that then gets applied later with all of the other process and procedural elements. So the challenge that I've seen, and that I'm sure Barton and Robert can attest to with our clients, is even when you've got good policies and good standards, you still have to implement them. That is going to require at some level some sort of procedures and some sort of processes that actually do the securing of the data and the infrastructure, whether it's network infrastructure or physical infrastructure on the ground. So when we look at these types of procedural elements, it's what's the process you go through when you buy a new machine? What's the process you go through when you set up a new firewall or set up a new website? Do you allow some third party to set up a website? And if you do, what kind of documentation do you provide to them with regard to ensuring that you don't have cross-site scripting vulnerabilities and other types of problems? The one thing also that I think is critically important that a lot of people forget about is your back-end databases need to have some sort of architectural components to them that allow for watching how that data moves around. And that's that meta-tagging of data that's at the bottom of that particular slide. I don't know how many of you remember The Weakest Link on television, but in oftentimes, at least in the security domain, people are the weakest link in any security posture. That means you also need to have process and procedural elements for your people. They need to be trained. You need to have the right kind of provisioning for access. That needs to be updated when their roles change. You need to have an understanding of not just your people, but the people that your vendors use. The other component associated with this is a lot of times, since people happen to be part of the weakness, a good procedural element that folks forget about or they don't think about is the capability of acquiring insurance for these types of mistakes people make. A lot of times, a security breach is simply a mistake. It's not somebody intentionally doing something wrong. It's somebody forgetting that they're not supposed to, you know, sell disk drives on eBay that have been decommissioned but haven't been cleaned. And as a consequence, there needs to be some way of procedurally recognizing that that may happen, but also understanding that you really don't want it to happen. Unfortunately, all of the best procedures and all of the best processes in place don't stop those mistakes. They simply mitigate them. And as a consequence, regardless of how strong your security posture is going to be, you're going to have an event. And that event management is that final component which is critical to your process and procedural elements for a strong security program. And with that, I'll turn it over to Bart, who has a better explanation of what will go into that event management process.
And thanks, John. And I think the point is that there are two parts to this. There can be situations where you have an actual breach, and there are situations when you believe you have a breach. And the third situation is you could have what your technical people think is a breach, but by law, it is not a breach. So as part of you've implemented good practices and procedures to help mitigate your risk, and now you have a situation that comes up, and you get your team together, and we'll talk a little bit about your team a little bit later on, but your team is going to be comprised of people from, you know, IT, compliance, law, maybe your corporate communications, maybe your client relationship manager, and it may even decide to bring in outside people into your incident response team, depending on the size of your company and the size of your severity of the situation. But the key thing is going to be determining from a legal standpoint and from your company standpoint what you ought to do, and do you have any legal requirements to take any additional action. And unfortunately, there is right now, at least in the United States, a wide disparity of state laws that deal with this situation, and I'll try to, and some federal, that try to touch on this point on what you have to do. So the first thing is identifying what is a breach, and there are three elements, and it seems like, oh, gee, this is a very simple thing. You know, you have an unauthorized access, disclosure, use of personal information. But, you know, as with many legal issues, when you have definitions in a statute and technology is evolving and the world is evolving, it doesn't necessarily play out that way. Usually, there are different laws, and the different laws define these terms actually differently. So, what is a breach in the United in one state might not be a breach under another law or a different type of information. So, health information is treated differently, protected health information, that is, than other personal information. Now, typically, and so, again, there's a lot of variations, unfortunately, and it actually, although I'm not always an advocate for legislation, I think in this instance, some form of baseline federal legislation would really help people out and would reduce the time and investment on outside counsel and consultants in defining what a breach is. But basically, these are the elements of what is normally a breach. It's usually Social Security number, a driver's license and state ID, or financial information, usually with a required security code. But there's a couple of states and that you don't necessarily even have to have the security code taken. But these are generally the piece of information that when they are taken control over, that would be in an unauthorized fashion, would typically be a breach, absent some other exceptions. But one thing that's important in terms of a takeaway is that email address and name in and of itself is not considered to be a security breach under these state laws. And also, if a Social Security number not connected with the name will also not be considered a security breach. Now, that doesn't mean you just say, oh, we don't have a legal obligation to notify. What me worry? But, obviously what it means is you still should, if you do have a situation where there's unauthorized access, you still are going to want to respond accordingly. You want to close the breach using the vulnerability, working with your internal or external tech people to eliminate the situation. You just may not have determine that you don't have a legal obligation, and you may also determine that even though you don't have a legal obligation, you may or may not want to notify. I've had several clients over the years decide that, well, they don't think they have a legal obligation, but the company's relationship with its customers or its employees is so important, or that the information is so out there that they want to go on. You have a question on whether a PDF is a piece of paper. That is a question that I've argued over with the California Privacy Commissioner several times. I take the position that a PDF is and again, this is not legal advice. Remember the disclaimer at the beginning. But I've taken the position in many cases that a PDF of like an I-9 form is basically a copy of a paper document. So a paper record is not doesn't trigger a breach except for in a couple of states. But remember, these if you talk to your IT staff, they would say, of course, a PDF is computerized data. So it really depends on who is asking and who is answering the question. But even if you're dealing with only written documents, you've got a couple of states, Massachusetts and South Carolina, that a breach of written records is a security breach. So in a situation when you do have a PDF or an Excel spreadsheet being sent around, I still think one, it's going to be whether or not your company wants to take a conservative position. You want to analyze the severity of what the materiality of the situation is, and then make a determination. But I think I can make compelling arguments in many situations that a straight paper PDF copy of a paper record is a written document. Although, when you're fighting against a regulator in court, and they'll say, well, why didn't you give us notice? And it may be still a position that you don't want to be in responding to a question. Well, we determined that this PDF wasn't, even though it is comprised of computerized data, that it isn't it was really a written record, and we decided not to send notice. Now, there's a variety of these security laws that will apply here, and you've got security breach laws, you've got Social Security number laws. There are several states that require written policies regarding Social Security. The most important statute in this realm right now is the Massachusetts statute, which actually has detailed security measures. So many of the measures that John referred to in his presentation are actually codified in Massachusetts. So if you're a company that has a has an employee or a consumer in Massachusetts, you know, you have some detailed security requirements to follow. And most of my clients either can't or don't really want to. It's not economically practical to apply different security measures to data collected from Massachusetts residents versus data from someone else. So essentially, Massachusetts has legislated, a national, in my view, standard at least, for minimum security measures. And of course, California has done that as well in areas like in the privacy policy area. And some of the statutes talk about, there are some specific statutes, Illinois, for example, Texas, that they don't, unlike Massachusetts specifies you have to have a comprehensive written security program, and that comprehensive written security program has to contain a whole bunch of things. And I apologize in terms of time. We could spend a whole webinar presenting Massachusetts compliance, and we've done that in the past. But other states talk about what are reasonable measures. And, reasonable measures, many of them John covered in his materials. But overall, you have size makes a difference. One of the things that all the regulations and all the laws take into consideration is the size of an organization. But the key is whatever organization you have, you need to look at yourself. You have to see the input and output of your organization. Where does the data flow come in? I like to look at things relatively simply, and then, of course, it gets more complicated than I could ever believe. But I like using boxes and arrows and trying to track the data and find your company. You might actually separate out your employment data from your consumer data and do a data flow analysis and look at the points where it's being transmitted. Look where it's going to service providers. Look where you're collecting things over a website. And then you make your own determination about where are your key points that you need to be concerned about security-wise, policy-wise, procedure-wise, contract-wise, because every arrow between your organization and another organization is a contract that needs to be dealt with. Obviously, you have to implement, and that's hard in and of itself, because that means reaching out to people within your organization, finding the stakeholders, finding the people who actually know what's going on. So between the assessment and the implementation, someone or some group of people has to identify a larger group of people that know what's going on and can actually take action. Training is, of course, important because, as John mentioned, your employees are the key. I mean, they're the key to protecting the information. And also, remember, your employees are also stakeholders themselves, because every employer holds the information regarding its employees. And I would say, at 40% of the breaches that I see are in the employment space. And those can be, very significant, because then you're talking about your employee loyalty, and your employees have a lot of power with respect to use of consumer information too. One thing, as I discussed earlier, the vendors are really where it's at in terms of security breaches, and it's really important to spend some time thinking about what should be in your contracts with your service providers. And mind you, the Massachusetts law requires you to have certain provisions in your contracts with third parties who are collecting or holding personal information on your behalf. And HIPAA also requires that you have agreements with what are called business associates companies that are collecting or holding protected health information on your behalf. You know, there used to be the situation where where clients would say, well, come on, I've got a provision here that says I just require my service provider to comply with all laws. Well, aren't all the laws, isn't that umbrella protection enough? And I would say in today's world, it's not enough. There has to be, I think, due diligence on your service providers. You know, I had a case involving a breach involving a very large company, several large companies, who outsourced their employee benefits to a small consulting firm. And that small consulting firm had a computer repair issue, and they took their computers to the local repair store. Well, the local repair store was in someone's house, and in that house, that computer somehow was stolen. And as a result of that, we were talking about notifications to over 300,000 employees from at least three major employers. And would due diligence have avoided that situation? Would that have, having some understanding that that employee benefits consulting firm would not let their computers out of a physically controlled location with all that data to be repaired? You know, the answer is maybe, right? But with training, with due diligence, with assessment, and with pushing things down, everyone recognizing the issue serves to mitigate. And then the control of the breach situations are really important. Indemnification, of course, is important. That's if your service provider has the financial wherewithal to indemnify you in a breach situation. And control over the situation. Who talks to who? A lot of the state, under the state database security breach notification laws, it's sometimes unclear whether each party in the chain of custody of information should be sending notices. And if you don't want confusion, you do not want your consumers to be receiving three letters about the same breach. Or you don't want your vendor to send out a notification without your corporate communications people looking at it and making sure that if it wasn't the company's fault, that we're appropriately pointing the finger or appropriately handling it so that it isn't the goodwill. I write a lot of letters that say, try to write notifications and say, you know, look, we really care about privacy and security. We had this situation. Our trusted vendor did something wrong when we found out about it or had this breach. When we found out about it, we took immediate action. So it shows that the company is on top of things. And of course, if you're a service provider, then you still want to not yield total control because you don't want to have your customers putting all the blame on you. So hopefully the key is, there'll be some reasonable compromise regarding who controls and working together to get a resolve. So in terms of these laws, you've got electronic unauthorized use or disclosure and use of personal information. And then what are the notifications that need to be sent? Well, if you make a determination that you have to send notifications, and there are a lot of exceptions, again, you can kick it out off of a definition, or you can kick it out sometimes off of materiality issues. Encryption, if the data is encrypted, that is and the encryption key isn't misappropriated, that's a way off of the notifications. But if you do have an obligation, for example, if you're a service provider, it could be a notice to the owner of the data, or you send in, but someone has to send a notification to the individuals involved. And then depending on the size of the situation and the number of individuals in each state, you may have to send a notification to a regulator or HHS or consumer reporting agencies, law enforcement, or the media. So again, it depends on the state and unfortunately, you do have to look at some of the tweaks of some of the different state laws. And you, as a company, you also have to make a decision like, all right, if I have to send a notification to employees or consumers in one state, should I be sending it to everyone anyway? Should I treat everyone differently? I haven't seen a class action or a claim of treating different classes of consumers differently by state. But I think as a brand owner, whether you want to slice and dice your population that way, I just am not sure. So part of the things you want to do too, in order to like manage this whole process, is to get a team ready in advance. Get your incident response plan together. In terms of ROI, the Symantec Poneman report that companies, and they analyze, dozens of breaches over the course of a year. They determine that the cost actually goes down. If you have an incident response plan and you follow it, the cost of company goes down $42. So that's about, I think that's about 30-35% of what a company that doesn't have an incident response plan. So you want to, again, it's hard to say what, there isn't a one size fits all on any of these. Because I know on this call we've got people representing companies with 10 people, 10 employees, and over 10,000 employees, and companies with that are just B2B companies and companies that deal with tons of consumers. So, but the key is you have to identify a team that you don't want it to be too big of a team, but you want to get people that can provide you with the information and can help gather information and help make a decision. Identify your responsibilities and figure out when you're going to act and how are you going to act. And importantly, who is ultimately going to make a decision and who gets brought in and what particular time. And again, we can't deal with every particular situation, but at least just like we complain about doing a fire drill, every year in our buildings, going through that fire drill and defining responsibility, one, when it happens, you know what to do and you know how to act, and then you can act appropriately. And in this case, it's conducting that investigation, don't jump to the conclusion that there was a breach, but at least, and again, remember what I said at the beginning, there are breaches and breaches, okay? There could be a security breach from your quote-unquote from your IT department, but it's not a legal breach under those statutes. So you definitely have to remediate and close that breach, but then you have, and you also may want to report this to law enforcement to take appropriate action, because you may not be aware that this is part of a trend and there's actually investigation going on locally or globally against very similar breaches. And, of course, knowledge and cooperation is power in this kind of situation. Now, law enforcement is sometimes hard to get to pay attention, but it's always worth trying. And even if it's just a stolen laptop that you are reporting to local police, doing that allows you, when you ultimately decide to send a notification to consumers, that you can say, we've reported it to the police, or we're cooperating, we're conducting an investigation, we've reported to law enforcement, and they're taking appropriate action. It allows your company to do what any third party looking at your actions would say, that's reasonable. And remember, yes, we want to stop the problem and we want to protect data, but we're not only acting for the audience of the respondents, we're acting for the audience of a third party looking at us and saying, okay, you found something out. Did you act appropriately? Did you act reasonably? And when the New York Attorney General took action against one of my clients, it took action because it held that the New York Attorney General's office felt that the client didn't act reasonably and responsibly and promptly, because they took several weeks to declare and determined that they actually had a breach and spent a lot of time sort of trying to, well, not exactly trying to figure it out. But so I'm not saying you have to get a response together in a day, but you have to, remember, you're just acting for an audience later who's going to be looking at you, whether it's a regulator or a judge in a class action. Did you act reasonably? Did you stop the problem quickly? How did you respond? And on that point, before I turn it over to Robert, to receive one credit of CLE for this webinar, please write down the following code on the CLE attendance affirmation form, which will be emailed to you at the end of this week. The code is SS0848. And now with that note from our sponsor, I'll pass it over to Robert, who will talk to us now about how the class action plaintiff's lawyers are getting involved and how the judges are reacting when they look at how companies respond. Robert?
Thanks, Bard. Much appreciated. We have gotten a few questions with respect to the PowerPoint presentation. It will be emailed to you, but you can also get it from the drop-down menu. And then also a reminder that we will be fielding questions at the end, so feel free to use the drop-down bar to ask questions. So what we've covered with John and Bard is obviously compliance, how to effectively protect your data, and then what happens when your data is compromised and data notification requirements. And so the last leg of this presentation is what happens after there's been a data breach and what to expect as far as class action lawsuits down the road. And we've seen that. It follows a predictable pattern. Once the data has been compromised, once notifications have been provided, it's not unsurprising to see class actions pop up across the country in multiple jurisdictions. In some cases, for large data breaches, we've seen up to 50 class actions against one individual company shortly after the data breach. Now, traditionally, plaintiffs have had a difficult time sustaining privacy class actions because they cannot plead, let alone show, actual injury flowing from a data breach. And that's a necessary component of Article III standing and jurisdiction. But what we're seeing more and more is courts more receptive to arguments and allowing the plaintiffs to move forward from the motion to dismiss and being able to move forward with class certification motions. Now, just yesterday, there was a decision that was very helpful for companies. It was an Illinois state court decision. And what the court essentially ruled was that the plaintiffs couldn't show that they've actually been harmed or that their data was stolen or used for purposes that they hadn't authorized. That was as of Tuesday, a decision came out on that. And a similar decision earlier this year, a D.C. federal judge gutted a wide-ranging multi-district case on a similar type analysis, that there was no actual harm and no showing that the data was stolen or used. But what we're also seeing is some other cases where the plaintiff's bars are being very creative. There was recently a case in California where a federal judge allowed a putative class action against LinkedIn to go forward based upon allegations that the site's security representations and its privacy policies were false. And based upon those alleged misrepresentations, the plaintiff was able to withstand a motion to dismiss. Most of what you're seeing is, and it depends, but a lot of times on these data security breach class actions is that they're alleging a nationwide class. Sometimes it may be limited because they're suing on a particular state statute, but if they're relying upon a federal statute, typically you're seeing a nationwide putative class. And some industries are targeted more than others, particularly healthcare information and financial information, but we're seeing it across the specter as far as different industries being targeted by the plaintiff's bar. Now, in addition to just protecting your information and having a data security response program in place, you also have to add to your litigation costs having to deal with these class actions, and often it's class actions in multiple jurisdictions where you may need to get different counsel or local counsel, and so it can be quite expensive. There's been some recent headlines where executives and CEOs have been scrutinized and lost their jobs as a result of data security class actions and the implications to the company's bottom line. And directors and officers are becoming much more acutely aware of their responsibilities from Sarbanes-Oxley compliance perspective, as well as other regulatory requirements, to make sure that their company has adequate data security protections in place. Now, there's various different statutes, federal and state, and different claims, common law claims that you see in this data security privacy breach sector. And like I said, you know, based upon the LinkedIn case, we're seeing a growing movement to try to find liability. The plaintiff's bar is getting much more creative. We're seeing claims brought for breach of fiduciary duty and breach of contract. In the case of LinkedIn, breach of contract based upon the terms of service and the arrangement that LinkedIn had with their subscribers. The strict liability, it really becomes more along the lines of a statutory violation. And that's where the rubber really hits the road as far as the basic issue that if a statute provides that there is a penalty or a fine for a violation, in the absence of actually any showing any actual damages or actual harm, will that be allowed? Is that actionable, and can you withstand a motion to dismiss? And many courts are moving in that direction, that if it's a statutory violation and it's a statutory violation that provides for a penalty or fine, that it can be actionable. Other claims that we see brought are negligence, unjust enrichment, violations of various federal statutes such as John and Bart mentions, HIPAA, Gramm-Leach, and then also state statutes, whether it's privacy or data notification requirements that weren't complied with. We mentioned the LinkedIn case. Now, common defenses that are valid defenses and that, you know, can help protect you in this regard, the main one obviously is the Article 3 standing requirement, and we'll get into the seminal case in that area. But and it kind of relates also to the concept of that there was no injury, that there was no damage. Essentially, the fact that, yes, the data may have been taken or compromised, but there's been no showing that it was misused. And that's where those standing arguments sort of all center. Other typical defenses in this sector is that the case is not appropriate for class certification. For example, there's predominance of individual issues, or that there's an inappropriate class representative. When you get into the privacy and there's privacy policies, there can be issues about consent, that you can create individualized issues that can help defeat class certification. And then on the economic loss doctrine, that's a mechanism where you can basically say tort versus contract, that under the economic loss doctrine, liability is not appropriate here. Now, the seminal case that we discussed is the Clapper case, and this is the real friend to the defense bar here, and there's some very helpful language in this decision. The bottom line on the case is the case involved privacy issues. It didn't directly address data breach issues. In Clapper, the plaintiffs included attorneys and human rights organizations, and they challenged the constitutionality of a provision in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, claiming that their work required them to engage in sensitive communications with foreign individuals who the plaintiff believed are likely targets of surveillance. The issue before the Supreme Court in the case was essentially whether the plaintiffs had Article 3 standing or not. They claimed that their communications would be intercepted sometime in the future, and I think that's the key, and that their present injuries included taking costly and burdensome measures to protect the confidentiality of their communications from surveillance. And the key takeaway on this case is that the court held that the plaintiffs failed to establish standing, concluding that the threatened injury must be certainly impending to constitute injury in fact, and fairly traceable to a violation of the statute. The court went on to say that it was highly speculative that the government would imminently target the plaintiff's communications, especially given the plaintiff had no actual knowledge of the government's targeting practices. Now, query whether in light of the Snowden kerfuffle, whether that would still be applicable, but at least we still have this case. And then lastly, the court said that although the plaintiffs claim that the threat of surveillance required them to take costly and burdensome measures to protect the confidentiality of their communications, they could not manufacture standing merely by inflicting harm on themselves based upon their fears of hypothetical future harm that is not certainly impending. And so what does this mean? The bottom line is on that is this, is that oftentimes in these data privacy cases, the plaintiffs try to create standing by saying we had to get credit insurance, or we had to basically get our credit monitored, and basically say that that's the, you know, the harm that they suffered. Those are part of the damages they suffered. And several courts across the country have rejected that based upon Clapper, using this language is that you cannot manufacture standing. And you'll see on the next slide, we've kind of done a summary for you, and again, you'll get a copy of this material, of some of the helpful cases for the defense side, and then also one case that the plaintiff's bar still puts their hat on, and that's that Sony Gaming Networks case, where the court found that Article III standing exists even without allegations of misuse of the breached information. So long as the breach occurred, and even if there was no showing that it was misused or that the plaintiff was harmed, that particular court found that you could withstand the motion to dismiss. As you can see, there's been a number of high-profile cases, Barnes & Noble, SAIC, where the court found that the case could not proceed because mere loss of data was not sufficient to maintain the class action. Now, we're seeing some emerging strategies from the plaintiff's bar, and I think this is where we're headed, and this is where companies need to be prepared. We have a new injury theories being proposed by the plaintiff's bar. In this Goodman case, the court found that injury in fact existed where the defendant's collection of location data took a heavy toll on the battery life of the plaintiff's smartphones. So you can see that we're going to sort of indirect tangential connections to show the injury. Similarly, in the Hulu privacy case, again, that was a alleged violation of the statute. And again, like I was saying, as far as if it's a statute that provides for a claim and provides for damages, that's where the plaintiff's bar is arguing that this standing requirement you don't need any sort of heightened scrutiny, and the fact that the statute provides the cause of action and the remedy is all that you need. And that's what is consistent in the Hulu case, as well as in the Juul case. This was a key Ninth Circuit case, and the plaintiff asserted that there was no specific injury from the surveillance devices attached to the communication network of the defendant. The court found that the violations of the federal surveillance statute represented injuries in fact, because a concrete injury by Article III may exist, and this is the key language, solely by virtue of statutes creating legal rights, the invasion of which creates standing. And so I think that's where you're going to see a lot more arguments made by the plaintiff's bar. Another key case for the defendants, and this is a great case for the defendants, and the key takeaway here is the court found that the predominance element was not satisfied, and this is the Hannaford Brothers Company case. The court addressed the requirement under Rule 3B3, that questions of law or fact of common to the class members predominate over any questions affecting only individual members. The court found that while there may be common issues of liability, it grappled with the issue of damages. The court noted that there was some contrary First Circuit precedented, but it also noted that when the issue is related to the causation of damages, common proof is required. And the court found that while expert testimony could have helped the plaintiff establish their claims, the plaintiff had presented no expert expert opinion at the class certification stage. And essentially, because the lack of an expert opinion at trial would require an individual determination of damages, and because the court was unwilling to assume that the plaintiffs would find an appropriate expert, the court denied certification on predominance grounds. So I think this case provides a good roadmap for how you can try to defeat class certification. And I know we're running up against time, so there's been some obviously high profile cases against Google, and I think the main issue here is just to highlight that consent, individual consent in some of these data privacy class actions can be a key issue and can be a way where you can help defeat class certification, particularly if you have robust terms of service that have appropriate disclaimers, and you can show that the plaintiff was aware of the collection or was aware of certain issues. It can create a good defense on the consent issue. Another key issue to be alert for is, companies, how do you pay for this? And John mentioned, on the compliance side, on the data notification side, insurance is available. There's also insurance available for class actions themselves, and more and more companies are going towards obtaining insurance. And query whether, officers and directors actually have an obligation to do that. I think they probably do, to make sure that their company is protected. Now, there was a case, important case, earlier this year where the court found in New York that there was not coverage under a commercial liability policy. And I'll direct you to that case in interest of time. But it's an important case. There is a split of authority, I should note, and a California case went the different way and found that there was actually coverage under this commercial liability policy. I think the key takeaway on insurance is make sure your company is not just relying on a commercial liability policy, but also has a data breach coverage policy as well. With that, I'd like to turn it over to our panel. We did receive some very helpful questions. I'll direct this question to John Tomaszewski. The question is, I'm new to this area, and I'm now responsible for data security compliance. If you could identify some key things about where I should start getting up to speed, I'd appreciate it.
Sure, and I think to that point, you've got two things you've got to do very quickly. The first one is identify a champion. So make sure that you've got somebody in the C-level or on the board of directors who really understands the risks associated with doing this wrong and is willing to support you in terms of what you're doing. The second thing you need to do is just figure out what kind of data you hold. If you don't have credit card numbers, then you don't have to worry about PCI compliance. If you don't have Social Security numbers, then there are a whole bunch of problems that you don't have to worry about. Inversely, if you do have Social Security number and you do have credit card number, that's going to change your threat profile. And so that's going to be the first thing you need to find out is what kind of data does your company have that you need to protect and what kind of rules are around that.
That's great. Thanks, John. Bart, question for you, but before we get to that question, somebody wanted us to reread the code. Could you reread the code for the CLE credit?
Sure. There's a couple of simple questions we can answer. The code is SS0848. SS0848.
Great.
Someone also, there were a couple of requests for the reference to the Massachusetts statute, and the regulation, the Massachusetts Data Security Regulation, is 201. CMR 17, 201 CMR 17.
Now, Bart, we got a question. Yeah, you referenced this incident response team, and obviously we know how important that is. The question is, who should be on that team?
That's a good question. It's like, you have to look at who your stakeholders are, and I'm not trying to duck the question, but every company is going to be a little bit different depending on how big they are. No doubt there should be your IT person involved who understands data flows and understands how to either solve this situation or bring in outside resources to solve the situation. Clearly, there should be a legal component to that, either in-house counsel or if you don't have an in-house counsel, an outside counsel. That counsel you may not need to bring in at right at the beginning, but there's going to be a certain point you'll want in-house or outside counsel. Some companies will have their own chief privacy people or security or privacy and security. Several companies will have chief privacy officers and chief security officers. Companies will also may have chief compliance officers, so someone from the compliance department who understands the industry regulations that apply to your particular business should be part of that team. At a certain point, when if it goes past, if you know it's an actual breach, I would bring in on a key matter, I would bring your client team liaison. If it impacts on a significant client relationship, I'd bring that person into the loop on a case-by-case basis. And also at a certain point, you bring in your corporate communications department, because that corporate communications is going to be creating standby statements, maybe weighing in on the communications to consumers. So those are, I think, the people that, that's not the entire universe, but those are the primary people that I would want to have on my incident response team.
Great. Thanks, Bart. So in the interest of time, we'll do one last question, but we appreciate all the other questions. We'll reach out to you directly on those questions, and feel free to reach out to either of us on the any additional follow-up questions you have. Question for me had to do with arbitration and how does arbitration play in this world. Arbitration provisions are key. How do you avoid the class action lawsuit? Employ arbitration provisions, prohibiting class-wide claims. That's a key under the Concepcion case. That is a key way you can help defend yourself against these type of class actions. So that's a very good observation from one of our audience members. With that, I'd like to thank you all for participating in today's webinar. As I indicated, you'll be getting a thank you note that will also provide you with the PowerPoint and some additional information regarding our practice. Our next webinar is going to be on June 17th, and it's going to be on the latest developments in non-compete and trade secret law across the country. We have a very good panel put together. And just lastly, wanted to remind you to check out John's blog. He has a great blog on global privacy issues, and also our trade secret blog, tradesecretslaw.com. Wanted to thank everyone for participating, and Bart and John for their time today. Thank you all.
This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.